thing about individual rights is that they are always under threat. The tide is always pulling against it, and it has to be shorn up. The mechanisms enforcing these rights have to be shorn up, because power will always come for it. It's always coming for it.
I think the British mentality is, we're free and things are going well and we trust you to get on with it. The function of the state for us is just keep us free, keep us safe, and keep basic services in place, and let us get on with our lives.
Yeah, you guys seem very trusting.
Yes, we're trusting. Generally. You could have called this podcast Trust and Paranoia. If you want a working title. Would you like a working title?
Hello there. Welcome to the first and only episode of this podcast that I suppose I'll be calling Trust and Paranoia. I'm an American civil rights attorney now living in England, and today I'm going to be exploring some of the major differences between the US and England in terms of how we view our governments and what legal mechanisms we use to hold them accountable beyond the ballot box. The US and the UK are both democracies where our governments are supposed to be accountable to us. But what happens when there's a failure of democratic accountability? When the people you voted for aren't the ones in office? Or when you belong to a group that doesn't have any political power? Or when the government official isn't someone you get to vote for, like the police? What is the backstop then? In the US, it's the courts and our constitutional rights. In the UK, it's their European Convention rights and sort of the courts. Your remedies are limited. And if it's the police, there's literally no mechanism for legal accountability outside of suing an individual officer for damages. When I first started learning about this a year ago, it shocked me. But what shocked me more was when I started talking with my English friends and colleagues. They seemed completely unbothered by certain things that just felt fundamentally wrong to me as an American. There was so much trust, indifference. I couldn't really understand. I started to wonder why no one seemed to care about their rights and how the majority of British citizens seemed to think they lived in the freest nation on earth. On the other hand, a lot of people seem to perceive Americans as overly obsessed with our rights, even paranoid. I mean, I can't say that they're wrong. We literally have more guns than people, thanks to our Second Amendment right to stay armed in case of another revolution. To be clear, a right I would be happy to have repealed. Personally, I wouldn't call myself or most Americans paranoid, especially if you look at what's going on these days with our current Supreme Court and our circus of a presidential election. But we definitely have a very different view of what the terms rights and freedoms mean than they do here in the UK. To delve more into this, I conducted two interviews, one with two of my colleagues here in London, and another with my former supervisor. My colleagues are Rebecca Scott and Joe Moore. Becky is a solicitor originally from Liverpool, and Joe is our receptionist who grew up in London. My former supervisor is Corey Stoughton. Corey has been a civil rights attorney in the US for over 20 years. She worked for the American Civil Liberties Union and the Department of Justice, and then she ran the Special Litigation Unit at the Legal Aid Society in New York, which is where I met her when I was working on police and prison reform lawsuits. Coincidentally, Corey and I both grew up in Michigan, which you'll hear her mention briefly, but more importantly for this conversation, she has lived in England on and off for many years and also served as the advocacy director and executive director of Liberty between 2017 and 2019, so she really has a unique insight into this topic. Here's part of my interview with Corey.
Do you think US citizens and UK citizens have the same perception of rights, or do you think that term means something slightly different?
Yeah, I think it does in so many ways. I mean, there's so many different directions. One way One way in which I found it's different is that I think when we as Americans think about rights, the kind of paragon or quintessential rights are negative rights, rights to be free from something. And again, that kind of relates to the individualistic spirit we were discussing earlier. So, you know, our core rights, you know, if you say to America, you know, what are my rights? They're going to talk about freedom of speech. They're going to talk about, you know, privacy, about things that have to do with individualism and independence. And I think in here that would get mentioned, but right alongside it and not in any, not one step behind it would be positive rights, you know, rights, the right to life, the right to, you know, equality or the rights, you know, positive rights to a certain, you know, level of, you know, of comfort and kind of support. And that is a really profound difference. And you see that reflected in American constitutional law as opposed to human rights law here. So that's one really big difference. But the other difference is, I think in America, we have more of a sense that our rights belong to us inherently. Maybe this is more of a kind of a legal perspective than a kind of popular perspective. But I think people understand rights as rights that are given by government. And it's important to remember that in the UK, historically, people were subjects, not citizens. Whereas from the very beginning in America, America was founded on the idea that people should never be subjects and can only be citizens. And I think that there's a strain of that that doesn't exist so much in the popular understanding, because I don't think there's a single British person who doesn't consider themselves a citizen and instead considers them a subject in that sense. I mean, there, you know, certainly there are royalists who enjoy being a subject, but legally, you know, rights are given. And even though the European Convention on Human Rights grounds rights in an idea of natural rights, that idea is not integrated really into the understanding of rights here. And we can see that in the fact that whether or not the UK should even continue to be part of the European Convention on Human Rights is a live political debate. And in any case, you know, it's not directly applicable. It's only applicable through the Human Rights Act, which is an act passed by Parliament. So the ability to enforce those rights or give them any meaning is entirely dependent upon a grant of, you know, a legislative grant of rights to people in this country. And that, to a degree that I think people in the UK don't really understand, is really hard for us, as an American to wrap my head around.
Yeah.
It's really contrary to what we understand, because as Americans, our rights pre-exist everything. They have existed, we think, I mean, this is, you know, whether this is the reality since the founding of our country. Now, of course, the reality is much more complicated. Those rights initially only belonged to a select set of people. Those people were white. There's a lot to say about that. But nonetheless, kind of in how it's distilled into our consciousness and how that is developed in the law as it's evolved alongside America's evolution, I think it's very much understood to be inviolable, you know, something the government cannot take away, because they didn't give it in the first place.
Yeah, I feel like I've experienced that or observed that as well in the US. We think of rights as something that protect us from the government. And here they seem to think of rights as things they expect from the government, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very interesting. As you said, learning about how their rights are only from international law, from this European Convention, I still have a hard time wrapping my head around it.
Just to explain quickly, while in the US we have our constitution that was written at the founding of our country, in the UK human rights come from the European Convention on Human Rights, which is an international treaty. In 1998, Parliament passed a law called the Human Rights Act, which allows British citizens to bring human rights claims in UK courts, but the substantive rights are only part of international law. In the last decade, there has been a few politicians who have mentioned leaving the convention. Even if it is extremely unlikely to ever happen, the idea that their government could just choose to withdraw at any time definitely triggers my American paranoia. Here's me talking with Joe and Becky about this.
So there's this quote, it was actually attributed to, I think, Thomas Jefferson, but they later decided someone else said it. But there's this quote that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. And
nice.
A study done a month ago said that a majority of Americans still completely agree with that sentiment.
Yeah, it's very different culturally.
And 74% of Americans are very worried that essentially if we aren't vigilant, if we aren't careful, then we will lose our freedoms.
Okay.
It does. I'm just not getting the same level of worry here.
We'd be eternal ignorance or oblivion.
Yeah.
You see, we take all that as a given.
I guess
that's all serious stuff, and we're like, we've got that.
But okay, but that's very, that's super interesting because.
Yeah, no talk.
Because it seems, so it seems, as you said, so it seems British people take these,
we take
these convention rights
we
as
take,
given.
Yeah, they're given.
But they're actually,
they're given.
They're not protected in any way. Mm. What I mean by that is if Parliament, well, one, if the UK just wants to withdraw from this convention, they can at any time.
I mean, you're showing that we take it for granted, but that's our life experience, isn't it?
Yeah.
We have those things and they're not going anywhere.
Okay, so it doesn't bother you at all that your human rights are only in international law. You have no domestic, you have no UK, it doesn't bother you.
Things are going okay.
Okay.
When I hear Brits say things like this, I honestly think, gosh, that sounds so nice. Such a peaceful way to live. I'm not sure if I'm jaded or just American or just me, but our whole viewpoints just seem really different.
It feels like Americans have a different relationship with our government than British people have with their government. It seems like there's a lot more trust here, and I wouldn't necessarily, I don't even want to say trust in like, because I don't, most Brits I've spoken to, I wouldn't say they like love the government. Yeah, I think they all realize the government has faults. There's distrust here and there, but yeah, I just have found people here seem to view the government more as a like a well-meaning parent who ultimately wants to look out for them. Where Americans, we just feel like we're constantly defending ourselves against the government rather than, I guess, trusting them. I don't know. Have you experienced that? Have you observed that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Fundamentally, I think there's both a cultural and a political difference. Cultural in that the ethos of America from its very inception was skeptical of power, rejecting of power, like formed in opposition to power, whereas this country is a traditional monarchy, which is, you know, fundamentally a worship of power, of consolidated power, and both countries have moved away from those oversimplified notions into much more robust, nuanced understanding of power and relationship to power. To be sure, but that is at kind of at the spiritual root of each country. It's really diametrically opposite. Root, but it's also political. Again, I think this goes back to democracy. I mean, it is easier to trust your government when democracy works.
Yeah.
And you know, the truth is that democracy has never worked in America perfectly.
Corey is absolutely right that our democracy has all kinds of issues that I won't even begin to get into. But even if democracy is working better in the UK, is that enough accountability? From what I've seen, it seems like to the average British person, yeah.
So would you say the biggest way that you can hold the government accountable is with your vote?
Ultimately, yeah. We just trust them to get on with it, Tori. we just trust them to get on with it. I think the British mentality is, we're free and things are going well and we trust you to get on with it. And if you don't, if you break that trust, we'll will vote you out.
Have they broken that trust? Is there an example of when they've broken that trust and been voted out?
The last election.
But what about the last three elections?
Yeah,
they've been in power for a long time now.
But at the end of democracy, this is the downside to democracy. And at the end of the day, you can't blame a government for being voted in.
Are you aware of any current laws that might be infringing upon certain rights, or
I'm not sure of the specifics, but there is a protesting one. I think it's to do with the amount of people gathering or something. Or
yeah, so there's I actually can't remember which piece of legislation it is right now, but
is it the criminal?
I think the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act.
Yeah, I think they've done something very dodgy lately, and there's really heavy sentences coming down on it.
Yeah, there's heavy sentences, but as an American Fourth Amendment nerd, which is search and seizure, the thing that throws me in that act and other ones is that it essentially gives police the power to do suspicionless searches.
Right.
So
right, yeah.
In the sort of debatable provisions having to do with protests with the Public Order Act are that now, according to the recent edits to it or whatever, if there's a protest happening, the police can essentially get temporary authorization to do suspicionless searches of anyone who's in
the vicinity.
This particular vicinity.
Yeah, yeah. And it did shock me, the sentencing that's coming down from it.
Yeah.
Because they're after the Just Oil protesters. But actually, you know, really this law will apply to any protester. And I was like, someone got 3 years? And I was thinking, no.
I think the leader might have got 5.
Yeah, and I was like, that's more than a rapist gets for demonstrating. So I was kind of like, things are going really wrong here.
So, I mean, I agree. I think things are going very wrong.
Yeah.
But what is the, I mean, I guess, so then what?
Like, yeah.
As a British citizen, so then what?
Yeah. I mean, what I would expect with that is, you know, I don't approve of it, but I then would say to myself, well, I'm sure some organisation will challenge that on my behalf. So Liberty being an example. So I would just go to myself, and that's the apathy of the English person, isn't it? I go, that's terrible, and it's monstrous for me to read about it in my newspaper, but I won't be doing a damn thing about it because I will expect
somebody else.
And I also sit there and go, I didn't vote for that government, and I never would, and I'll be voting them out the next chance I get. And part of me goes, people are getting what they deserve. If you vote for people like that, that's what you're going to get, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the amount of people warned about voting Tory, especially the last election, they did it anyway.
You get the government you deserve, don't you?
At the end of the day, they're elected in.
Yeah.
What can you do?
But they're not elected by you.
This is the part that I have a hard time relating to. This idea that once the government is elected, if they do something that violates your rights, then there's nothing much to do other than blame the people who elected them and wait until the next election to fix things. Becky's right, though. There will be someone at Liberty fighting against that law. And for a while, that someone was Corey. Here she is again telling me about the differences between what you can do here and in the U.S.
Can you just discuss a little bit, sort of like procedurally, how the enforcement of rights differs? Like if you're trying to enforce a constitutional right versus European Convention right under the Human Rights Act, how do those look different?
Well, I think one of the biggest differences is the remedy that you can get.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in America, you can strike down acts of Congress or your acts of your state legislature, an act of a legislative body. You can literally erase it. It's quite hard to do that. I mean, I think sometimes British people think you can do that willy nilly. There are a lot of steps. You have to make quite a showing to do that. But if you can you know, overcome all the procedural hurdles and make the requisite showing, it's possible. And here it is absolutely not. You know, you can get what they call a declaration of incompatibility, which is just a declaration from the court that there's something inconsistent between the legislation and a human right principle. But ultimately, whether that gets fixed or how that gets addressed is entirely up to Parliament. And that's a really big difference. It takes a lot of power out of the courts and leaves it in the hands of Parliament. On the one hand, if Parliament's the problem, you know, that's not so good. On the other hand, you know, it's really hard to be an American right now and be a big fan of the exercise of judicial power.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think we're seeing in America a lot of the downsides of our quite powerful judiciary, and what happens when it gets into hands that aren't really that have let loose some of the norms that have historically restrained the judiciary from overly interfering with legislative priorities or even, you know, exhibiting in some instances partisan tendencies. So I think, you know, it's interesting, you know, kind of which one is better or worse. I feel very conflicted about that at the moment, to be honest with you. But I think as someone who has represented people who really needed safeguarding from the abuse of power that was driven by legislative acts, you know, I have found it stifling here in the UK, that we couldn't get more powerful remedies for clients who really needed protection from, you know, from majoritarian forces or from acts of parliament that were driven by, you know, that were informed by a real lack of respect for individual rights. You know, for example, when I think a really good example of this is, you know, ever since, especially after 9/11, you know, there was a huge push to expand government powers to invade people's privacy. And you know, we understand why. We all felt unsafe. And there were threats to America and threats to the UK that needed, you know, that were terrifying. And so the democratic forces produced a raft of both legislative enactments and executive acts empowered and authorized by legislative enactments. And this is true in America and it's true in the UK, that really massively expanded the powers of government to conduct surveillance. And we're still living with a lot of those laws now. And judicial challenges to those actions were much more successful in America because of the remedies that were available ultimately, because those laws could get struck down. And here I think we see that the vast majority of the Investigatory Powers Act, which was the major statute that kind of embodied a lot of those expansions of power, survived. I mean, you know, Liberty and other organizations have undertaken heroic efforts to try to constrain and pull back on some of those abuses. And some of those have been successful around the margins, but the kind of core challenge, the idea that the government can use surveillance powers without kind of any specific cause or evidence to kind of believe that a specific person, you know, should be invaded, that didn't happen here. And I think that's a really good example of the ways in which the more powerful constitutional enforcement mechanisms in America can be used for good, even though I do think at this point that's not always happening.
Yeah. The fact that technically Parliament could pass any law they wanted, even if it blatantly was in violation of convention rights, and that no court, I mean, no one really has the power to force them to do otherwise. That was like a very...
It's shocking, right?
It's a strange concept for me. Yeah. I'm still trying to...
And you know, it is a strange concept it isn't actually to a lot of people in the UK, interestingly. Again, it's kind of this question of, do you want these things to be decided by courts or do you want them to be decided by the people? And I don't know.
This idea of parliamentary sovereignty and the lack of judicial review is one of, if not the biggest differences between our governments and our legal systems, and one I don't think I'll ever really feel comfortable with. It just seems like all the power is concentrated in one central body. And let's not forget about the monarchy, who actually still holds power, even though they've agreed never to use it.
Do you think most Brits know that the monarchy like still technically has power?
I don't think they do.
They don't.
They don't. I don't think they do.
I found that crazy.
I think they think they launch ships and give interviews to Hello magazine. I was taught in politics, so again, that's a subject that no one's studying, but they were like, well, that's a nice extra check, because actually if your legislature goes mad and says next week we're going to kill all redheads, as an example, that was the example I was given, if your legislator goes mental and passes that law and gets whipped up into a frenzy, that's when the monarch will step in and go, actually, I'm not signing this one. For once in my life, I'm not signing it. So that was trained into me that, you know, now you can say that's a flimsy justification for having a monarchy, isn't it? But, and it is, and they're completely unelected, and I don't believe in divine right, and I'd ban them tomorrow. But it was, it was one of the positives, was you've got another little check here, because nothing becomes law until it's signed by the king or queen. And that hasn't gone. The day could come where they go, I'm not signing that one.
Could that check be elsewhere though? Because in the US that check would be in our executive branch.
Or in
the courts.
And in my view, I'm a Republican. There's no justification for having an unelected monarchy.
Yeah.
I just don't believe in it. I don't believe in divine right. But we've retained it, haven't we?
We've more retained it.
We can't be bothered putting their heads on sticks.
Why do you think you've retained it?
Because they don't rock the boat.
They don't rock the boat.
I think there's a perception, right or wrong, that there's this really long history and it's always been done that way. And it's kind of working and we're just going to leave it alone.
I think America, as in the difference between here and America, is that we just love the status quo, and it's been the status quo for so long. And it hasn't really been, to be fair, I think the closest we've got to ever like revolution was probably the general strike in 1926?
Yeah.
And even then, from there, the government changed radically pretty quickly because they knew that. But other than that, there's not really been a threat to normal life.
Yeah.
Whereas in America, it's like that bloody quote from Jefferson. It's like, live in paranoia, be careful, this could change. It is not a given. Here, it's like, well, it bloody well is.
Yeah.
Well, but it bloody well isn't.
Well, it is.
It only is because the monarchy chooses not to exercise their power, because Parliament chooses not to often pass.
Part of the culture, though, of the British culture, rightly or wrongly, is that we have a belief it's always been this way and it's going to be okay.
Yeah, and so far it has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean,
and it doesn't mean to say we're right. And we could just be all going along in absolute bliss. But the mentality is that there's a long history and this is working for us.
Yeah.
It's generally working for us.
That, and I just think...
Long history, loads of shameful episodes in it. But the country we've arrived at is generally working for us.
Yeah. And I think the Parliament and monarchy would be far too scared of that again. Too bad for the normal people. I mean, at the end of the day, One Nation conservatism was literally brought about to make the working class a little bit more equal with the upper class so they wouldn't revolt. And that only came, and David Cameron was One Nation conservative. That is insane. They're literally already been like, we need to make sure, in history, been like, we can't make this gap too big because look at France.
Yeah.
Like, there will be a revolution. Look at
it. It's a worrying time, though, because there is a rise now in this country that I haven't seen. There is a populist thing happening now. There is
far-right extremism happening, and that it is worrying, isn't it? Especially when MPs are buying into it.
You know, MPs are buying into that now, and Nigel Farage has gotten a seat, something I never thought I would see in my life. So you're right that we can't be complacent, but we're still complacent because we'll go, he'll do one term, he'll get voted out.
Yeah.
That's never going to catch on, you know.
Again, this is one of those instances where I just don't know how they feel so secure.
It feels like people here on the day-to-day don't feel under threat the way some of us in America do. They don't feel that like something's going to be taken away from them or suddenly their lives are going to be, you know, turned upside down by some court decision, some government decision. But as an American civil rights lawyer from our background, the idea that like it could and we just trust that it won't here is just, it's like a new world for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think, you know, this part of the conversation makes me really think about our positionality in the conversation. And because I think if you're us, you know, two white women from Michigan who, you know, not rich, but not economically, not fundamentally economically unstable,
yeah,
not immigrants, although we're immigrants here.
Yeah.
You know, for people in the UK who, broadly speaking, look like us,
mm-hmm.
not members of a racial ethnic minority, did I say that? You know, anyway, but yes. I think that it's probably right because, again, democracy works. They probably aren't at risk that much. But where we, you know, where, you know, to your point, if you're on the margins of power, of democratic power, and of society, of social protections, you're an immigrant. You know, you're a black person in Brixton, you know, walking the streets and exposed to, you know, abuses of police power. You know, I mean, whatever, you can keep going. I mean, you know, you're not protected, right? You don't have the same access to legal protections as you would if you were in the same position in America. I mean, that's true.
Yeah.
And it's why, you know, whether it's on immigration matters or on the surveillance issues that we were discussing, you know, it is harder to have accountability. You know, I mean, one difference we didn't discuss when we were talking about the differences in how rights are enforced, I mean, this is a bit niche, but it's an important niche, is when it comes to what I call institutional reform litigation, which doesn't really exist here because there's no mechanism for it.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is when somebody sues a government institution because it's failing,
mm-hmm.
And it's failing in a way that violates people's rights systemically. So that institution could be a police department, it could be a social care home, it could be a prison or jail. And you know, I've done a lot of that kind of litigation, and as a result of that litigation, there are times when courts, appoint independent monitors to take over those institutions,
yeah,
to reform
them. Yep.
And that sometimes in cases of deep institutional failure, which tend to happen in institutions that are not particularly well protected by the democratic process because nobody cares what goes on in a prison and jail, for example, or you know, the majority of people don't care enough,
yeah,
to do anything about it or spend the money it would take to kind of bring it up to basic standards of human rights. You need that kind of intervention or the threat of that intervention to ensure that minimum standards are met.
What Corey is talking about is called a consent decree. It's one of the main legal mechanisms we use in America to deal with systemic constitutional rights violations. And the one I am most familiar with, because when I worked with her, that's mostly what we did. We would sue the NYPD or the Department of Corrections, not just for rights violations that had already occurred, but for ones that would occur in the future if they didn't change their policy or practice, you know, the general way they were doing things. Essentially, it's a form of injunction where the court orders the defendant to take prospective steps to prevent future violations, and they appoint a court monitor to instruct them how to do that and essentially make sure that they do that indefinitely. One of the most well-known and successful examples of a consent decree is this case called Floyd.
The NYPD had an incredible pattern of abusing stop and frisk, stop and search. And ever since 2017, it's been quite a long time, has been under a federal monitorship to oversee their practices. In part because of political change, and obviously, but in part because of that, stop and search rates dropped like something like 80%.
Yeah.
Since their height when the litigation was brought. You know, the Met Police have a stop and search problem. That's been reported on extensively. Mm-hmm. But there is no mechanism for a court, for people to come to a court and say, you know, this is a department that is systematically violating people's rights. It's discriminatory. It's suspicionless in a way that is ungrounded and, you know, disproportionate in a human rights way. And so, and this has been going on forever, and they don't seem capable of fixing it. And so you court need mm-hmm. to appoint someone to go in and force them to get in there, mm-hmm. look at the actual policies with an expert eye, and have the power to say to the police, the commissioner of the Met Police, like, you need to do X, Y, and Z because this failure of training, this failure of policy, this failure of internal accountability and discipline for misconduct, these are the contributing factors, and you need to fix them at a kind of granular level. There is literally no mechanism to do that here. And yet that happens, definitely not routinely. I mean, it is very difficult to get that done in America. But if you can make that showing of systemic failure that amounts to a violation of the law, you can get that. And it has been gotten. And it has been actually very successful. That model of reforming institutions, because sometimes those institutions need a kick in the pants. And I've done a lot of policing work. I've done it, as you know, with legal aid and at civil rights organizations. But I've also done it at the Department of Justice, where in a model that I think really blows British people's minds in the same way that the lack of constitutional rights blows our minds here. The federal government can sue state and local governments. Mm-hmm. When they violate the law, and the federal government, because of federalism, cannot directly tell state and local governments what to do in their prisons and jails or in their police departments, but can go through the courts to use the same mechanism that private litigants can use to get the courts to kind of impose a set of reforms. Mm-hmm. And they do that. And that's what the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division does. And in that work, I can tell you, because it's a government institution, they try to be in dialogue with state and local governments first and foremost before resorting to litigation and suing them. And the Department of Justice is in dialogue with state and local governments and police departments. And I will just tell you, there are police departments that have embraced those kinds of reform mechanisms, because sometimes institutions need external pressure to change.
Yeah.
Especially when they need deep culture change, which for police departments, for prisons and jails, for any institution, is sometimes actually the root cause of a lot of these really deep systemic institutional mm-hmm. failures. And so I actually think that mechanism is great.
Yeah.
I don't think it should be used frivolously or willy-nilly or routinely. I think it should be, it's a dramatic remedy, mm-hmm. And it should be reserved for cases where certain showings can be made, but the absence of it here, I think, is a shame. And I think that the failures we see in some of those institutions that are often the target of that kind of reform litigation in America, police, prisons, and jails, mm-hmm. is evidence of why it would be great if they had something like that.
Yeah, and that's probably why the Met is so slow to change, and maybe why some of the...
I mean, the Met, don't get me started on the Met, because I'll tell you all about how I think the fundamental problem with the Metropolitan Police is that there is no meaningful accountability. And that is partly about, judicial, mechanisms of judicial accountability we were just discussing, but also there's a lot of models for police accountability around the world. Mm-hmm. Not all of them have to be, consent decrees imposed through judicial power. The Met has none of them. I mean, there's literally no meaningful accountability for the Metropolitan Police. And that is, I think, the number one root cause of you know, of the problem. I mean, you know, there's a huge culture problem in that department, but the way you change culture is through accountability mechanisms to implement things that change culture. And there's just there's nobody who has the power to go in there and say, this is what you need to do right now, do it. The mayor of London can't do that. Parliament could do it in theory, but they don't do it for reasons that are, I think, obvious, which is in terms of like democratic accountability, mm-hmm. the way that like broad political actors are going to always interact with the police in a democratic, I mean, it's just never going to happen. But there's just no, you know, the IOPC, which is the, I think that's still what they call it, that oversees the police department is not, I mean, bless them, but it's not an effective institution. I mean, they're great people. I don't want to be mean to them. It's not their fault. It's just not a powerful enough institution, period.
Because it's like an internal. It's like
it just doesn't have any enforcement power. Yeah, I mean, it can be ignored. And it is ignored routinely.
Yeah, that seems to be the general problem, is like the judiciary or any type of organization that is meant for oversight doesn't actually have the power. They can sit there and say, oh, we don't agree with this, or we think this is in violation of something, but who has the actual power to say, no, here, you have to do this.
Yeah.
In search of answers for how police might possibly be held accountable in this country, I talked to Dr. Megan McElhone. She's a researcher who primarily focuses on racism in policing. She told me they have something called a public inquiry, where the Home Office hires someone to conduct a formal investigation, but it's not entirely clear how effective they are.
So they do the inquiry and the investigation, and then they make findings and recommendations. Mm-hmm. But at that point, it's just ultimately up to Parliament or the police, because, you know, they're not the judiciary. Like, they don't have enforcement power. So it's just kind of a, we think this is wrong and you should do this, and then we hope that they do that.
I think for the most part, again, in the inquiries I'm thinking of, it will depend on the nature of the recommendation. So mm-hmm. I think because it goes before, the report, I guess, is addressed to the Home Secretary in the first instance. So if there's a recommendation, for example, around stop and search, which says you should be recording stop and search, then they probably consider that and whether that needs to be involved in Act of Parliament being created, for example. But in other instances, I think, you know, where a recommendation is more around institutional policy or practice, that likely goes to the chief officer of whichever force is implicated.
Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it's all discretionary.
I don't think that they, I'm not sure who would hold them to their compliance with those recommendations.
Or if there is a way to hold them to compliance, like...
There may be, but if there is, I don't know about it.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't seem like there...
Like, who...
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to understand, because that feels like a big way through which reforms are happening.
It also shapes the stories that the British people tell themselves about their police. Because they stamp authoritative narratives on usually highly controversial events.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't say Stephen Lawrence inquiry now without thinking about police institutional racism. And that's important, but I suppose the role of a commissioned inquiry, in one view, would be to seek out the truth of the matter, and a more skeptical view might say, actually, it's just to shape the story that's told about what happened here.
Yeah.
With the effect then of, as I said, shaping how the British people understand the nature of policing here.
Yeah, which, I mean, there's a huge value in that to influence, manipulate the public's view of the police. I guess if the public feels like things are being handled or taken care of or looked after, that's going to alleviate some of the pressure.
Yeah, it'll take the hate out of it, for sure.
To do much more.
I asked Corey about inquiries too. Unsurprisingly, she had a few opinions on them.
I really get upset at how often in this country, I'm going to get all kind of Trumpy on this, saying elites. And by this, I mean the media, I mean politicians, mm-hmm. Anyone you might attach the label thought leader to, really mistake inquiry for accountability.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no end of inquiries in this country. And a lot, the inquiry tradition in this country is admirable in a lot of ways. I mean, the depth into which they go to examine and really, really turn over all the evidence to kind of figure out what really went wrong here. I think that's wonderful. But at the end of the day, I mean, I don't know when it first occurred to me, but after some time being here and being really engaged in a range of issues, I realized that these inquiries, they happen, they issue these findings, they're very impressive undertakings. Everyone involved in them has devoted so much time and energy and done such an incredible job to produce these results, and then nothing happens. I'm gonna exaggerate slightly for effect here, but like, nothing has to happen. That's definitely true. And that's extraordinary. And ultimately, you know, there's always like a big, you know, media, the findings of inquiry, and then everyone moves on. And I just, it drives me crazy. It drives me crazy. I mean, everyone moves on. And then you look at over history, I mean, the police inquiries are a great example of this. How many times are we going to have an inquiry that leads to the same conclusion that there's systemic racism in the Met?
Yeah.
I mean, there have been at least two in my lifetime. They're probably, you know, are we going to have another inquiry when my children are, you know, grown-ups that just comes to the same conclusion? Is this just an endless cycle we're going to repeat? I mean, that's what I fear will happen, because at the end of these inquiries, nothing meaningful happens. And for reasons that I think in part are because people lose focus after the inquiry is over, even mm-hmm. though the inquiry is just should be just the first step towards real accountability, and in part because of a lack of institution, like lack of threat behind it, right? And this it takes us back onto track. What would be different in America? I'll tell you what would be different is that if we got these robust inquiries in America, somebody would then sue.
Yeah.
And they would win because the evidence of the inquiry would be an incredibly strong showing, and they would get, you know, straight into court, and then there would mm-hmm. be a meaningful enforcement mechanism through judicial power. And that's what would happen in America. And, you know, I think on the flip side of this, that's probably why we don't have such a robust inquiry tradition, because people are terrified of it, because it's very difficult to get people to engage in the inquiry process because they know that litigation is at the end of the road. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not trying to be one-sided about this. I think that's the kind of give and take of this. And mm-hmm. I do think that part of why they have this incredible inquiry tradition is because they protect the inquiry, but at the expense of accountability. And maybe you can say in America, we have accountability, but at the expense of, truly independent inquiry. And we have to rely on judicial processes, adversarial judicial processes, to substitute for that inquiry. So we have fact-finding mm-hmm. mostly takes place through these lawsuits instead of through these independent inquiries. And that's not ideal. I mean, I think the independent inquiry model, as I've said, I think that's an incredible model, a really admirable model, and it leads to probably on the whole better results than the adversarial process. At least how it's done here, and the way that it's the incredibly strong way it's done here. But it's the trade-off is the lack of accountability at the end of it.
I know part of the reason they don't have the same mechanisms here as in America is due to the lack of power vested in the judiciary branch. But as Corey said earlier, there are other mechanisms of police reform that aren't consent decrees or judicial review, yet the Met hasn't used any of them, despite pretty clear evidence that they're doing all kinds of things wrong. I asked Megan why she thought there wasn't any accountability with the police here, and she told me a little bit about the historical relationship between Brits and their police.
The British self-image is, we are compelled to act in accordance with community virtue, and we have direct nostalgic links to this parochial governance, and we can trace our history in that way. And our police are not repressive like they are in Europe or in the colonies, all the states, which of course is former colony, but you know what I mean, mm-hmm. Kind of has exceptional status as a colony that has for a very long time rebelled against the motherland.
So you're saying that the British viewpoint of the police kind of reflects the overall British self-image.
The British self-image, their understanding of us versus them, the us is the police.
Mm, mm-hmm.
The them is the very many other sort of segments of the population who'll be othered upon the basis primarily of race, but things like immigration status and so on. And certainly the idea that, yes, the police are us, they are just citizens in uniform, they ensure our public safety, and they do so by securing our consent, obscures the fact that police work has always been about reproducing social order. And I think it's important for me to add the qualifier there that those people who are socially and economically marginalized certainly do know about that, you know, the police's role in social order maintenance. But broadly speaking, I think the police are able to lay claim to public consent amongst the British populace. And in turn, the British populace are less likely than others, for example, in the States, to conceive of the police as being capable of rights violations, and certainly to think that the police need to be systematically scrutinized and held accountable for any such violations. Although, again, another important qualifier is that there are ebbs in public confidence in the police. We're certainly in the midst of one now, I would say. And so, yeah, none of this is without qualification, but there's a different starting place originating from bodgy histories, which means that the British people, I think, are feeling indebtedness towards the police and an affinity with the police that you might not see in other places.
This part of our conversation really resonated with me because a theme I've seen over and over when talking with Brits about their government is a reference to expecting the government to keep them safe, almost as though they see safety as a right. It seems like a very big priority here. And I've always thought it was one of the reasons the UK is the most heavily surveilled state other than China, yet no one seems to mind because everyone justifies it as being for public safety. America has its own extremely complicated relationship with policing. It was originally first designed as a slave patrol, and the US government has continued to use policing and the criminal justice system in general for the purposes of racial oppression, also under the guise of protecting public safety. But I don't think Americans identify with the police the same way. I think there's a pretty ingrained view that they are the government and not our friends. In fact, most of our constitutional rights are protections against police abuse specifically, because in colonial America, the British police were doing all kinds of terrible things. Our Fourth Amendment, for example, protects us from unreasonable search and seizure, because at the time, before the American Revolution, the British government was issuing these broad warrants allowing government officials to enter anyone's home they liked to search and seize prohibited goods, or in other cases, look for evidence of seditious libel. These warrants would be issued for pretty much indefinite periods of time. As a protection against this, the Fourth Amendment set the default presumption that a warrant was needed for any search, that the warrant had to be extremely specific on who was to be searched, what they were searching for, and that a magistrate had to approve it based on a showing of probable cause. There are for sure exceptions, but generally suspicionless searches in the US are quite rare, and the burden on the government to prove a justification is much higher than it is here. In my interview with Joe and Becky, we were discussing one of the suspicionless search powers that they have here in the UK, and you can see that we have wildly different feelings about it. I think it illustrates what Megan said about the differences between how we relate to our police.
If you're a law-abiding citizen, you'd have got nothing to worry about. If you're a law-abiding citizen, you've got nothing to worry.
It's so interesting because my reaction, it's visceral, the reaction.
Yeah, it's very different.
At the end of the day, if you know you're not carrying drugs or a weapon, then don't feel about yourself.
But this is, to me is such a fun, this is the fundamental difference.
Yeah.
I I can't even point to a lot, like as a middle class white woman who is not committing any crimes, mm-hmm. I'm not the person that this law that's typically is discriminating abused. Against, is abused. But there is still, it's just a fundamental, you can see me reacting. The idea that a government official, that the police, that anyone can just come up to me and go through my stuff, even if they're not going to find anything, even if they're polite about it, it feels so
wrong.
Internally wrong to me. And
it's just the same as what you do if you're going to an airport.
Well, no, airports are different because there's an idea of consent.
Yeah,
the idea is that we've agreed for the safety of everybody.
It's not the same thing.
No, because if I'm protesting, if I'm going out to exercise.
This is a new one, by the way, this one. I do disapprove of this one. I think you should have suspicion.
Oh, you've got to have one. No, you obviously
you have aside from this protest one, you have, they're called Section 60 searches. Since the 90s, I think, Section 60 searches have been...
Which would, to be fair, been used mainly racistly.
Like, it's still this idea that that the police, if it's like an area where crimes have occurred, they can just go search whoever they want with no suspicion.
My only thing is that I obviously disagree with the fact that it's used massively against people of colour, etc. But if you look at the numbers about how many knives have been taken off the streets through Stop and Search,
isn't it?
I mean, considering when knife crime rises in a city, the government aren't acting on it in terms of funding youth services to stop these things from happening at the source. What do you expect people to do? As in, at the end of the day, I've got no problem with a police officer going through my bag or patting me down if it then means 10 minutes down the road, he starts to search someone and they take a knife off of them that could be used against myself in a situation or any other civilian. I've got no problem with it.
Even if these searches actually recovered weapons, I don't think I would approve of them. And I'm not sure if that's because I'm a paranoid American obsessed with my civil rights, or just because I've seen the real impact of police abuse of power in the US. For the record, these searches are super racist and don't actually help public safety.
The arrest rate's very low as well, maybe 4%. And usually there's a low match rate of the item recovered and the item proceeding. So they'll often uncover small quantities of drugs, for example, rather than knives.
Yeah, so it's not very effective even at whatever the aim is.
Certainly not the articulated aims, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is absolutely wild to me. I don't think I will ever be able to adopt the British view of government or rights or feel okay about a lot of the laws they have here. And I think that makes sense, seeing as the country I was raised and indoctrinated in was one literally founded on an explicit rejection of the British government and everything it stood for. I also want to be clear that I certainly don't think America is some shining beacon for human rights and government accountability. We have the highest incarceration rate in the world. We're still executing people who have been exonerated. And almost everyone I know has been impacted firsthand by some type of gun violence. Whatever legal mechanisms we have, we obviously need them. And I think that's the most important takeaway. As the British say, we've just got to keep calm and carry on with what we have available to us.
I think as a constitutional and human rights civil rights lawyer, one of the things that we just have to grapple with is that our mechanisms are imperfect. I mean, the United States Constitution, not a perfect document by any stretch of the imagination. And all the time, as a person who has kind of proudly borne the banner of a protector of constitutional rights, you know, there have been people who said to me, well, you have a lot to answer for. What about that Second Amendment? You know, what about the fact that the Constitution was written originally, you know, to kind of reify, you know, slavery? And there's just no question that the Constitution isn't the document that I would write if I was to sit down and write, you know, the Constitution and the United States Bill of Rights. I mean, it's the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments where most of our rights come from, is a crazy document. I mean, most of, you know, nobody even knows what the Third Amendment is. About
quartering soldiers.
Yeah. I mean, I know what it is, but you know, like, you know,
right. The average American,
it doesn't get used, yeah. You know, I mean, there's whole amendments in there that are kind of in a sense wasted because they're effectively not really enforced. I mean, they rarely come up. The Ninth Amendment.
Yeah, I was just going to say the Ninth Amendment, the
even
penumbra.
The 10th Amendment rarely gets used anyway, but you know, it's, you know, you think, oh, well, that's odd. Like, that's not a very effective, if you've got 10 amendments and you're going to try to embody rights and it turns out like, one of them's terrible and three of them are rarely talked about. It doesn't seem like a very successful exercise. So yeah, not a perfect mechanism, but, and the Human Rights Act is the same. You know, it's obviously not as old as the Constitution or constitutional rights, which is ironic because usually most things are older here than America. But in this instance, we've got the tradition trump card over the British people. But the Human Rights Act isn't perfect, but it's now what we've got.
Yeah.
And just like with the Constitution, not perfect, but it's what we've got. I think it's absolutely, it makes perfect sense to me that we have to defend it at this stage, because the thing about individual rights is that they are always under threat. The tide is always pulling against it. And it has to be shorn up. The mechanisms enforcing these rights have to be shorn up, because power will always come for it, is always coming for it. And so to the extent that our Constitution in America and that the Human Rights Act are the place where those rights are safeguarded, we just have to stand behind. My feeling is we just have to stand behind these mechanisms and try to fix their imperfections or work around their imperfections. But the notion, I'm not a revolutionary, as you can tell. Yeah. I mean, the notion of kind of scrapping something and starting from scratch and hoping that produces a better world does not resonate for me. I fear that, and I think that the forces of power, especially in our current society with kind of authoritarian tendencies bubbling up and massive economic inequality, I just don't really think it's the time to attack the institutions that are protecting individual rights against abuses of power.